This show is part of the Pika Science podcast, studying the intersections of gaming and science.
You've journeyed long and far to this distant world in search of lost knowledge. You found the temple, but search for a missing tome. Quick, roll an investigation check. 18! Impressive! You search a few rooms, and there it is, hidden in a compartment behind a throne. You open the tome and begin looking at the magical script. Roll an arcana check. Natural 20, success! Now it's time to unlock all the knowledge of Ben Richten's Guide to Monsters and Lore.
All right, hello everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Ben Richten's Guide to Monsters and Lore. My name is Ben. I'm here today
featuring Clarissa, who explains it all.
Clarissa. Oh, is that a Greek, what's the word?
No, it's a 90s TV show from Nickelodeon.
Oh, I should know that. I'm a 90s baby.
Are you thinking of Cassandra?
Yes.
Who my dog is named after, Cassandra of Troy?
Definitely thinking of Cassandra. See, I knew there was something in there.
Yeah, that's Cassandra of Troy.
Well, we're almost giving it away what today's episode's about. Y'all are used to this by now.
Well, if they didn't see the title, I mean.
That's true. You know what? Well, I was going to say, y'all are used to this, how this series works now. We look at the real-life mythologies behind some of our fave D&D monsters. We look at a particular geographic region in each episode. For the fourth episode, we are looking at the most influential...
Wait, is this the fourth or is this the fifth?
I think it's the fourth, not counting any of the, like, secondary parts or special episodes we've done.
Okay, I'll say we've done quite a bit.
Because I think we've actually had like 7 or 8 episodes, but it's because we've had double parters.
Yeah.
I don't know. We love to talk about monsters. That's what matters. But today's region, most influential, or at least most popular for mythological monsters, of course, we're talking about Greece.
Oh, honestly, you're the one that I want?
Hmm? Oh. honey.
You mean the most problematic play ever?
And why does every high school in America do it? Like, I have
tell
questions.
Tell me more. Is this date rape?
Ooh, maybe.
Kanicki, what just came out of your mouth, Kanicki? No, Kanicki, we don't do that here, buddy.
The real monsters.
The real monster is Kanicki. The real monster is Kanicki.
Oh my gosh.
40-year-old men playing 17-year-olds in a movie.
Ooh, yikes. But... But I would so much rather talk about mythological monsters, not real ones. And honestly, this episode in particular could be an entire series by itself because Greek mythology has so many monsters. I'm not sure why, like, honestly.
Zeus is obviously the biggest one.
You know what? If we're talking sexual crimes, yes.
I think just in general, like, as a person...
An entity.
Because in Ohio, one of the things fourth graders have to learn is Greek and Latin roots.
Nice.
So we've been doing, it's also the year that they start doing like mythology, folklore, fairy tales. And we have been talking about it. One of the kids brought up Hercules and I was like, well, you're not going to like the real story, guys. And I was like, first off, it's Heracles. And I was like, second off, like, Zeus is a terrible husband, and Hera is not Heracles' mom, and she tries to kill him, and that's the entire story.
Not exactly fun.
Tries to kill her stepchild.
Yeah, we kind of sanitize. We kind of Disney-fy a lot of the myths, I think. But what are you going to do? I do want to point out, Greek mythology basically is, like, foundational to the idea of monsters within human culture, specifically Western culture, because, you know, let's not erase like all of ancient East and South Asia. China's history with monsters goes just as far back, India's history. But Greek mythology is still the largest origin of monsters in D&D, especially the 5e series. so many monsters have Greek origins. We are only highlighting a couple today.
I think it's frustrating because, and I want to be clear, I don't want us to borrow ideas from modern belief. I mean, it still happens. Like, golems are there. Well, and like, I guess D&D has no problem doing it too. I mean, we've talked about Arabic and why is that? Why isn't there more? Now you got me thinking. I guess the real answer is that a lot of the D&D stuff is either like Mediterranean or very much Western.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not a whole lot of Mesoamerican, which, come on, give me like a giant, man, some of those things are great. There's not really a whole lot of Asian stuff in there either.
Mm-mm. And a real dearth of African too. I mean, African mythology goes way back just as well. So yeah, there's a little bias. So that, I don't know, kind of led to people being most familiar with Greek monsters. I think it's a really, really popular fantasy region. Like Percy Jackson TV show just came out.
Yeah, but like D&D's like most famous monsters are like Beholder. So it's not like they couldn't just as well, you know, lift up some other things.
Right.
Get on it, D&D 1. Come on, get on it.
I'm just going to say, they might. I don't know. D&D 1, there's a lot of expectations riding on it, but we will see.
All the expectations and all the letdown.
Yeah, hopefully not, but guess we'll keep our eyes open. So yeah, we, apart from all that, we're only going to highlight, of course, just a handful of monsters today. We're not going to talk forever and ever and ever, even though we could, so... just a handful. But before we jump into the specifics that we've pulled together, I do just want to make a little like historical, like pre-inquiry, pre-question to this. Why does Greek myth have so many monsters? What I found to answer this question, one answer I found, at least according to National Geographic, ancient Greek people were likely inspired by archaeology and paleontology. They were really good at digging up fossils, and apparently they treated them similar to how we do now. So they set them up in public displays, kind of precursor to modern museums. They used them to speculate as evidence about paleogeography, which is the study of ancient geologic environments. And in this line of thinking, ancient Greeks even analyzed their own geomythology, which is the use of mythology to explain the natural world. The example that National Geographic gave is the myth of the hero Cadmus, who was instructed by Athena to plant a field full of dragon's teeth, which would then raise up a crop of human warriors. And a philosopher named Polyphetus explained this in the ancient Greek era as a myth of explaining why they found so many fossilized mammoth teeth in Greek agricultural fields. So they were already using myth to explain their own natural history. It's kind of like the ancient history before ancient Greece was happening. So that's pretty cool. And we kind of still do that now. Using myth to explain natural occurrences. Otherwise, the proliferation.
Wait,
of monsters,
you mean like the eclipse and earthquakes? You mean like Marjorie Taylor Greene does?
Listen, I didn't say all of them were like believable or successful, but yes.
Marjorie Taylor Greene believes that the eclipse is literally an episode of Full Metal Alchemist.
I wonder if she watches anime.
It's where she has the idea for space lasers.
Yeah. Oh,
that, or she like watched Austin Powers and thought it was a documentary.
Oh. Why do I want to laugh and also cry?
Because someone elected her to Congress.
Get out and vote, y'all. 2024.
It is an important year. We need you all to vote. We understand that some of you do not like one of the front runners, and that's okay. There's a lot of things I disagree with one of the front runners, but it's a lot better than going back to fascism. So vote.
And local elections also, yes.
Because if we still have democracy, we can actually change it. Once democracy's gone, it ain't coming back, guys.
Unlike a lot of these Greek monsters, which a lot of them are immortal and reincarnated.
I mean, that's only because the Romans took it, you know.
True. so speaking of all of those things, otherwise tried to explain why there are so many monsters in Greek myth, kind of just mirrors the existence of creatures we've talked about in all our other episodes in this series. They were just created by people as a way of finding meaning in a very chaotic and changing world. You know, culture and nature were colliding. Well,
and some of them are definitely like almost like folk tales, serving mm-hmm. the purpose to like teach lessons or to give guidance. And we know that, you know, some of the Greek stories are just epics. It's honestly like what, like the Greek mythos canon is one of the largest canons.
Oh, for sure.
I know it's not as big as like Hinduism, which we talked about with Andrew in the last Pokey Science, but it's up there as it has to be in the top five easy. Like the canon is just so extensive and there's so much there.
There is so much there.
But also, you know, being a culture that was around for so long.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the reach of the culture itself.
Exactly.
I think those are the two things that really made it what it was. I think that's really the key here, is that it's the reach combined with the time that really made it take off.
Oh, absolutely. Like the geographical reach and the like time reach, like we're still talking about Greek myth now, like thousands of years, hundreds, thousands of years later.
Well, it's also because like Greek and Latin are foundations of the English language. Mm-hmm. Like we were just talking about. That's why like fourth and fifth graders in Ohio have to learn Greek and Latin roots, because they are foundations. And that's mm-hmm. why they introduce mythologies, because that is part of the connection, is that like these words and roots come from mythologies too. That's literally how the standard reads.
Mm-hmm. See, when if y'all watch the National Spelling Bee, this is why they ask for language of origin. Because yep. they know their roots.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, speaking of all this, what monsters are we looking at today? We have five delectable, beautiful, amazing, scary, horrible monsters for you that we have found in our homing of
Greece. Yeah, we do have five, I guess.
We have five, but like... It kind of ends up being like five and a half.
Five and a half.
Because some of them are like a little... Yeah.
You're three. Five and a half. You're three. Five and a half.
Five and a half. What is our first monster? First up, we have the Gorgon. Y'all probably know about all these two, so if they're familiar to you, I love that. But in Greek myth, the Gorgon, or should I say Gorgons, plural, are the three female monsters named Steno, Euryale, and Medusa. I'm sure Medusa is the one that we all know most. They were able to turn anyone who looked at them to stone. The two sisters were immortal, but Medusa was not, and was slain by the hero Perseus. I'm sure we know the story. The term Gorgon comes from the Greek word gorgos, meaning grim or dreadful. Boy, that was a very fitting description, because this monster has been portrayed in very different ways across the centuries that it existed. They got claws, tusks, scales, wings, all sorts of weird features. Usually a woman, not always having snakes, but now that's become a popular imagery with snakes for hair. The wings came later, I think. But usually they looked really scary. Hard to say exactly when they first appeared in Greek culture, but certainly the Gorgon's a popular image since literally forever. It's been around for centuries. Their power to turn enemies to stone, as well as their femininity, was associated with protection of temples and the giving of oracles. Oracles were usually protected by a woman of some kind, a female servant of some kind. The serpentine part of a Gorgon is also related to protection, usually most of the time. But I will say that some ancient authors also attributed the snakes, specifically Medusa's hair snakes, to a curse from Athena, because Medusa slept with Poseidon. And in some cases, it says that Poseidon actually raped Medusa. I'm not sure which side of the story is correct or not.
I was reading that a lot of modern takes are that it was more forceful.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, if you know Zeus and then you think about Hades, those three brothers are very problematic in the way that they handle, I'm not going to say relationships, I'm going to say interactions. Because I don't consider those to be relationships, and that's not healthy to normalize that behavior.
Mm-mm.
But that is what I have seen, especially reading some takes into it. And it almost has made Medusa, especially like in the like lesbian community, an icon of, hey, I just want men to leave me alone.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's, yeah.
I mean, because if you think about it, like, she essentially, like, the Gorgons isolate themselves.
Yes, which we will see from some other monsters and from D&D lore, how these monsters treat their societies. It's crazy, though, because, like, Medusa, first of all, got this curse from Athena for an act that she didn't even want consensually. Like, she's kind of a victim, for sure. But we got other monsters to get to. What is our second monster? We got the Minotaur that we are focusing on. Half man, half bull creature, we know this. Minotaur, the word, comes from the combination of Minos, the king who controlled the Minotaur's labyrinth home, and then the Greek word for bull, which is also where the Pokemon Tauros comes from, because the Greek word for bull is Tauro. So, fun little Pokemon tie-in here. Originally, there was only this one Minotaur. It was just one bull guy, but since in modern times has become an entire species, since the 20th century, kind of turned it into like a race of bulls or bull men, however you want to say that. Not going to recount the entire...
Well, and this is Lila's very, 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 very first D&D character is a Minotaur.
Mm.
My kid at 4 years old found a Minotaur miniature and just had to have it. It was the first miniature she ever painted, and we still have it. There is an updated version that I made for her fifth birthday, I think. I got it printed, like special, like one of those Hero Forge ones. But like, you're right, it has changed. And I do know the story with this is that bowl, it also involves some rapey things too.
Yes.
Which is a commonality we see in a lot of the Greek mythology. God, how'd this suck being a woman then?
Literally.
Jesus. But yeah, I mean, because that's essentially the where it came from, right? It was like a child of a forced coupling of a... Because Brittany and I talked about it in the Greek episode we did last year on Hercules.
Well, and I have the story here if we want to recount it. Not going to talk, because there is the story of the slaying of the Minotaur by Theseus. Not going to talk about that. But
I think most of them know that.
Yeah, I'm sure that's another familiar. Same with the beheading of Medusa. Like, we know these are classics. But yes, the birth of the Minotaur is wild. So King Minos prayed to Poseidon to send him a bull because he became the king. I think Minos fought off his own brothers to become the king. And he was like, Poseidon, give me your favor. So he was like, send me a bull. And Minos was supposed to sacrifice the bull. Poseidon did send it, but it was so beautiful, that Minos kept the bull, did not sacrifice it. Poseidon kind of got pissed at him for this. And so he forced Minos' wife, Pasiphae, to fall in love with the bull. I think this was right against her consent to do this. She mated with the bull. I don't know how that went, but it did. And then bore the Minotaur as her son. Also don't know how that birth went. And then the Minotaur...
Very, 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 very painful.
That's how. I imagine.
Very painful.
Very painful. And then when the Minotaur was born, it is a carnivore of humans. So it needed to eat humans to nourish itself. And Minos is like, oh my god, that's so bad. So he locks it up in this labyrinth that he had his servants or brothers or someone build under his castle, palace. And that's where the Minotaur stayed until Theseus slayed it. Yeah, really wild. A little bestiality in there. A little non-consensual stuff. Some crazy royalty stuff. Fun myth. Yeah, other fun facts about the Minotaur while we're talking about it. Does have some connections to the sun and the stars, kind of a celestial being. This connection mostly comes from the Cretans, or the tribe that was living on the island of Crete, who depicted the sun as a bull. And also a fun fact is that the palace of Minos was actually found in real-life excavation digs in Greece, but the labyrinth underneath was never found. So it's not actually known if the labyrinth was real or just part of the myth. But Minos was real and the palace was real. So that's interesting. Yeah. Next monster. Moving on. This is woman power. feminist icon. We have the Lamia. Ancient Greek mythology, this was a child-eating monster, regarded as type of night spirit or demon later on in later traditions. So another example of a feminine serpent monster. I don't know what the deal is in Greek mythology between like putting women and snakes together, but
it's the sexism.
Yeah,
It's definitely something you see in a lot of cultures, and we know that it can be prevalent in certain belief structures. I mean, like the way I look at it, I don't know. We were just talking about this actually with my reading group. I have the highest one in the building. We were doing Narnia, mm-hmm. but we were focusing on like symbolism, mm-hmm. and so we talked about like the villain. Vilifying women, especially things like, you know, like the ice witches and ice queens and those types of stories, and how, you know, the common trend of doing so and like why that is a trope and where those came from. I know. I'm definitely an intense teacher. We also were breaking down Aslan, and I had this cute little girl shout out. She was like, oh my gosh, it's just like the Bible. And I was like, yeah, it is. Like, that's kind of point of us reading this was. I was hoping we could catch up on the symbolism and how it's kind of like pretty blunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of.
And then she was like, then she was like, well, Peter's the first saint. And I was like, yeah, there you go. All the names fit there. Susan, Lucy, Edmund. Like, it's a thing, guys.
Whoa. That's crazy.
I mean, a great way to introduce symbolism, though. And it was kind of cool to have the Greek connections with, you know, Tumnus being a faun and getting to talk about those things. So I do think that's important to look at a lot of our stories now and say, like, where is the connection to, you know, whatever? Mm-hmm. Where is the, you know, do we see those references and symbolisms?
Yeah, because, I mean, that's English class 101. What is the actual meaning of these stories? Exactly. Yeah. But yeah. The thing about this is that Narnia, I feel like Narnia is kind of like a feel-good, heroic story, you know, child-friendly.
You really haven't read all seven of them, have you?
Mm-hmm.
I said you really haven't read all seven of them, have you?
Oh, it's been a hot minute. I think I read all seven of them like a decade ago. All
right, well, maybe you'll rethink that later.
Yeah, I might. But, I mean... You know, barring all the details of the Narnia series, the Lamia here is definitely not family friendly by any means. It literally eats children. Often depicted as also sexually luring adult men and eating them. Seems kind of similar to a siren to me. Yeah, just this very common trope of like evil snaky women like luring and eating men. Very common thing. Origin story of the Lamia is kind of wild too. Quite the same as the Minotaur, but the story here is that Lamia was a beautiful queen of ancient Libya, like the country Libya in Africa, who had an affair with Zeus, that daddy Zeus once again. Upon learning this, Zeus's wife Hera robbed Lamia of all her children, including, you know, the offspring of her affair with Zeus, either by kidnapping or killing them directly. The loss of these children drove Lamia insane, and in vengeance and despair, Lamia then snatched up any children she could find and devoured them. I don't know why she needed to eat them, but she went off the deep end. And because of this cruelty, her physical appearance changed. She became not beautiful, super ugly, super monstrous, kind of horrible to look at. And Hera also cursed her with insomnia, so she could never close her eyes and never go to sleep. So she was forced to always obsess over her lost children. Zeus kind of felt bad about this particular point. So Zeus did give Lamia the power of prophecy and the ability to physically remove her eyeballs and put them back. So instead of like sleeping or trying to fight insomnia, she just literally took her eyes out. Kind of a loophole, a workaround. Interesting about this story is the myth kind of checks out because Lamia, the queen of Libya, is allegedly, ostensibly, a real person who was pretty horrific and aggressive in her war tactics, in her colonization strategies. There was kind of a folk myth that she like turned a blind eye to her soldiers' like bad conduct. So there was kind of a joke that she like took her eyes out, you know, quote unquote, because she wasn't paying attention to what her soldiers were doing, you know, pillaging and things. So the myth actually is kind of like a direct response to this real thing. And then the lamia also exists now in popular culture today, kind of as like a creepy bedtime story to get children to behave, you know, like don't go out and be bad or the lamia is going to eat you. Also, just as like an enduring mythological monster in general, the lamia has become since associated with witches and vampires, kind of like an anti-men trope, you know, like witches are brewing up stuff to punish evil men, vampires are sucking the blood out of evil men. Just kind of just this theme of like evil women empowerment for the lamia, which is kind of fun. Yeah. The next monster on our list.
Well, and like D&D goes in a very different direction with the design of this creature compared to like some of the other lore where it is more snake-like.
Yes, exactly.
I almost kind of wish they had kept its snake-like appearance.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I guess like we have the yuan, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we'll get to that difference in a bit. Yeah. Next up is kind of an interesting one. Kind of a, maybe one that y'all have not heard of and are not familiar with as much as these other ones. But this is the Eidolon. So not necessarily a classical Greek myth monster, more of a cultural concept. So in ancient Greek literature, an Eidolon is a spirit image of a living or dead person. Could be living or dead. A shade or a phantom lookalike of a human form. The word comes from a Greek word meaning like image, idol, double, apparition, phantom, ghost. This all, you know, same umbrella concept. Very similar to the concept of a doppelganger. So this is just the ancient Greek version of that. The most interesting thing I think about the Eidolon is how ancient like poetry authors utilized it. This specifically comes up regarding Helen of Troy, which was a concept explored by both Homer and Euripides. Maybe authors that you recognize. Homer uses a concept kind of just like a freestanding idea that gives Helen a life after her death. So, you know, kind of like that idea that there's a legacy that you've left behind after your death. And Euripides specifically entangles it with that. So there's this idea of glory, this idea that she needs to be remembered after death. And this is like a physical embodiment of that memory or remembrance. And then both Euripides and Stesichorus in their works concerning the Trojan horse, and this is a hot take, use the concept of Helen's Eidolon to claim that Helen was actually never present in the city of Troy at all. Like, she was not actually there. It was her spirit statue body thing, her Eidolon. I feel like that's a hot take. I don't know if I can corroborate whether or not she was there, but according to them, maybe she wasn't.
It's like Princess Peach. She was in a different castle.
All along.
You wasted all your life learning how to beat this game, guys.
What a shame. What a shame. Our last monster on this list, so exciting, so beautiful, is Pegasus. I'm sure y'all know Pegasus. Winged horse associated
with several elements. Yeah, that's what happens when Patamon has the Digi Egg of Hope. We all know that.
We all know this, right? Of course.
Common knowledge, guys. Common knowledge.
Get it in your brain. Yeah. the winged horse, Pegasus, associated with several elements of the earth, including specifically water and lightning. According to early stories of Pegasus, whenever he struck the earth with a hoof, a spring would burst out of the ground. And he also was said to have carried lightning bolts for Zeus. So he was kind of like Zeus's like right-hand man, right-hand horse. The birth of Pegasus, origin story, connected to Perseus, Medusa, and Zeus. So bringing back Medusa again. In one version of the story, Pegasus and his horse brother, Chrysaor, were born when Perseus beheaded Medusa, and her blood mixed with the foam of the sea, which kind of also implies that Poseidon may have also had a hand in the birth of Pegasus and his brother. And then at the end of his life, Pegasus' loyalty to Zeus resulted in him becoming a constellation. And since then, he's become super recognizable, also a common brand logo. I think we've all seen a winged horse. I think that might be the logo of ExxonMobil is a winged horse. So yeah, all over the place. But what's not to love? Horse with wings. Love to see it. This is where we get to the D&D lore of these monsters. And might I say, the D&D version of a lot of these monsters is very different from the lore of the Greek mythological versions. D&D, as usual, takes a lot of liberties with their stories and their lore here. The first one is the most different, Gorgons. So D&D splits Gorgon and Medusa into two different characters, two different monsters, and this is why. So Gorgons are actually mechanical bulls, bulls covered in metallic scales in D&D, and the bull version of a Gorgon, very different than the Medusa version, but it actually does show up in a couple other games. It shows up in Castlevania. It shows up in a game called Heroes of Might and Magic. And where this comes from is a book published in 1607, so like Renaissance era, by a guy named Edward Topsell called The History of Four-Footed Beasts. And I'm fairly certain we've actually mentioned Topsell's work in a previous episode. I think he might have been in the Persian episode. He was just writing all sorts of wonky stories about creatures in his time. Whether or not they're true, I don't know. But yeah, his storytelling really gave us a lot of inspiration. His version, like real life myth that he was writing about, was a type of bull that was bred in Africa. Specifically, he called it the Libyan beast. So there's that reference to Libya again. Had a really long mane that apparently people really thought was scary. And it had a breath that was so poisonous, it caused people to have seizures and to lose their sight and their speaking ability. Apparently, I got that from eating poisonous plants. He didn't really specify what plants are that poisonous, but wild. This mythology does show up in D&D and how they characterize the Gorgon, but they do kind of combine it with Medusa. So Gorgons have a unique ability to breathe a poisonous green vapor that then turns enemies to stone. So they kind of like mash them together. They are also unable to swim, and they constantly produce a waxy secretion to keep their metallic scales from rusting, because if the Gorgon scales ever rust off, they never grow back. And the skin underneath the scales is pretty vulnerable to attack. Yeah, so important to note that the Medusa, like the traditional Gorgon Medusa, does also show up in D&D, like I said, and her appearance is pretty in line with like what you would expect. Major difference though for D&D is that Medusa can be either male or female. And the funny thing about this is apparently in some regions of like D&D landscape, they are also known as Gorgons. So the game itself is kind of like making a joke about this mythological confusion between, are we talking about the Medusa Gorgon or the Bull Gorgon?
Or does D&D just have no continuity whatsoever?
You know, that is also a very, very possible
point. I think we've established that the continuity is constantly being rewritten, and at one point was written by people sending in newsletters to a magazine.
Yes, yes. That was early on. That is what happened.
I mean, that's a great way to build a continuity. Just ask random fans for their fanfic.
And
can you imagine if any other like any other fandom did that?
No. Can you imagine?
Can you imagine how many more yaoi couples we'd have?
Maybe we do need some more though. I'm so big. Oh my gosh.
Hey, we're the gayest duo. Look at that.
Woohoo. Oh boy. I don't even know how to transition that into the Minotaur, but here we go.
Speaking of twonks.
Speaking of twonks, we have the Minotaur up. Okay.
The world's hairiest power bottom.
Okay. Phew.
And Minotaur. That is why we remind people this show is not PG-13, or is not PG.
Right, PG-13.
It is very
check with your parents before consuming. Oh boy. Okay. What do we know about the Minotaur in D&D? Similar to Medusa, they can also be either male or female, which is different than the Greek myth is always male. They had the head and feet of a bull, so they have hooves and a bull head with horns, but they have a human torso and human arms. They are, by all accounts, in D&D, evil. They always have a chaotic evil alignment. They have connections to the Underdark. They serve the demon lord Baphomet. Not a good race of creature. Evil. I believe they were also sometimes kept as servants in the Underdark by races like the Drow, which we have talked about in this show in the Elf episode. Also an evil race. They share bodily proportions with ogres. They kind of have a pretty similar like bodily constitution to ogres, and their most iconic physical trait is their horns, which I think I read can grow up to 9 feet in length, which is that's so large. Like, these creatures are so large. But culturally, their society is patriarchal, quite aggressive and brutal. They really encourage their offspring to form rivalries with each other, like violent rivalries with each other. They will cast off any weak, especially weak female members of the society, like to the sidelines or however you want to call that. And a lot of their traditional norms are, you know, war, fighting, superiority, violence, all that kind of stuff. And apparently a fun fact about especially like the lead males is they drink a lot of alcohol. I don't know where they get it from, but yeah, they're like really not only violent, but also super drunk. So that's kind of an interesting fact about the Minotaurs in D&D.
Okay, so I want to add something. So I know we talked a lot about my world, my sandbox of Aethana, which is the first Flaming Dice campaign, and the one-shots that we recently did. That was great that I got to play in. So much fun, so much fun. I played a con artist.
Nice.
Me and one of my close friends, we played con artist wives, and definitely irritated Colin, who does our opening voice here on this show, who was DMing his first time, and he was like, oh my gosh, Madison, stop. And I was like, well, I purposely gave my character no physical attacks whatsoever. All social based, all goading, all manipulation, all like super bard. I loved it. Oh. But anyways, in Aethana, because again, like, you can homebrew however you want. In Aethana, the lore is, and the players haven't fully discovered it because we have some stuff to finish at some point that they want to do. Probably later in the fall when I've had time to knock out a good chunk of my principal's work. Yay, my internship. Yay. But we, in that world, like the anthropomorphic characters, so minotaurs, our Kakras are actually an experiment.
Interesting.
By an alien. Like experimenting with imagine. So do you know X-Men, like Mr. Sinister?
Mm-hmm.
Like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. So it's like a Mr. Sinister, like, what's going to happen if I mix their DNA like this? And that's literally how a lot of these lineages, not races, as we say it in our game, are come from. Or peoples. I actually use the word peoples. I was using the word peoples before D&D published lineages, which I'm happy they made the change.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, yeah. So we, like, Lila's character, Peaches, eventually ended up in Aethana. We, like, rebuilt her. And, like, the entire story was that someone, like, mysteriously ended up on the island where she lived. And she got, like, kidnapped almost like as, like, a trophy. Like, look at this weird creature that no one's ever seen before. Because the experiments are on like a continent that people don't visit. So the entire like purpose of the campaign was her trying to get home. Yeah, it was cute. We had a good time.
It's kind of fun.
But like in that regard, she made them vegetarians because she said they were like cows so that they didn't eat meat. And so every time the characters would go to like a restaurant or a tavern, like Lila made, and Lila was, I think, 6 at the time. She was in kindergarten when we were running that game. And she made a conscious effort to constantly be like, I can't eat the pork. I need some vegetarian options. I guess my kindergartner gave it, I guess she was in first grade at the time. My first grader gave it a very, very strong British accent for whatever reason. So you heard it here. Some your campaign world, Minotaurs can have British accents and be vegetarians. It's up to you. Whatever you want to do with it. Have fun with it, guys. Have fun with it.
Have fun with it. Exactly.
Yeah. Have fun. If Colin wants to decide that all the Yuan Tees have a Southern accent, then apparently they all have a Southern accent. So
whatever you want.
It's just a game. It doesn't matter, guys.
I love it. But I want to jump to our next monster because it is kind of the like mirror opposite of the Minotaur Society, which is super interesting to me. This is the Lamia, of course. So similar to the Minotaur, chaotic evil, that's about it, typical monster behavior, but Lamia is always feminine, serpentine, luring men to their deaths, you know, the way that it works in the Greek myth. However, in D&D, and this is what we were alluding to earlier, Lamia have actually the upper body of a woman, but the lower body of a lion, not a snake, which is in line with old Greek depictions of the lamia. Like, the lion body's not unheard of. It's just not common anymore, or it became less common as the snake body took over. It looks a lot weirder, in my opinion, to have, like, I'm not gonna lie, the first picture I saw of the lion body with the woman torso kind of looks like Giratina. Like, I don't know how else to describe it, but it has a very, like, sinister vibe to it. What makes this different than the Minotaur, or like I said, like a mirror difference, is that the Lamia is a matriarchal society. Men are just, like, not important to the Lamia. Men are meals, men are slaves. They don't give, you know, two hecks about men. It's all women here, baby. They're still committed to chaos, destruction, kind of problematic girl boss energy, eating human flesh, and they live in desert ruins. Apparently, they originated from what is called the Eldritch Mother of Demons in D&D, otherwise known as Pale Knight. She's also kind of a problematic, evil girl boss type of figure, and gave birth to the first Lamia, which then, I don't know how they reproduce, to be honest, but there's a whole bunch of them. It's a whole society, right? So that's the Lamia. Little different than the Greek myth, but also a little bit the same. Next we have in D&D the Eidolon. Kind of works the same as Greek myth, like, overall, but they added some, like, fun tidbits, I guess, to the history of the Eidolon in D&D. So they're a form of undead construct. Design pretty sole purpose for them is protecting a site considered sacred or important to a deity. Comparing to the actual Greek myth, that checks out. That's kind of what they do. Eidolons are spirits, so they have to be housed within a material body. So a statue, most often, a usually humanoid in shape, often constructed of stone that's magically treated to be purple. I don't know why Eidolons are made purple, but that's in particular to their vibe. And then usually have faces that are blank. So they're humanoid in shape, but not humanoid in, like, look. But they do have a, like, deified rune or symbol on their face that would kind of signify what deity they are working for. They had no free will, no purpose, that all they're doing is guarding the place that they're assigned to. They cannot leave this assignment. However, and this is the fun part that D&D added, occasionally Eidolons are known to be corrupted by that divine deity spark within them, or they protect the temple for so long that they go insane over time. When this occurs, their behavior becomes super unpredictable and chaotic. Their face symbols also leak a viscous fluid that kind of looks like blood. Super fun, super cool. So that is, I don't think this is common that they go off, you know, the rails, but it can happen. And then as for the origin of Eidolons, they're said to possibly originate from the souls of beings that were once alive that had unwavering devotion to whatever deity that they served. So if you are super loyal to your deity, maybe one day after your death, you too can become an Eidolon and eventually go insane because you can't move from this one spot. Kind of fun. What a fun way to spend the afterlife. Last but not least on the list, Pegasus, of course. What makes Pegasus interesting is it's the only creature on our list of five that we've picked today as a good aligned creature. Usually aligned as chaotic good. Kind of funny that out of all the monsters we chose, out of the ones we could possibly choose, Pegasus is the only one that's aligned as good. Kind of fun. It does make sense, though, because they only allow good-natured humans to use them as aerial steeds, and they know if you're good or not because they have the spells Detect Evil and Detect Good, which they can use at will. So if you ever become evil, you're booted. Pegasus is like, nah, you're out. Even if you had a good relationship with them before, you're done. Gotta stay good. Pegasus lives in herds, Pegasi, Pegasuses. Not quite sure the correct plural, but if there's multiple
Pegapie.
Of them, Pegzapie.
Pegzapie.
Pegasusai. They live in herds. That's what's important. In forest climates, originate from the plain of Arborea. Their eggs and feathers are extremely valuable, both as commodities on the market and as useful in medicinal elixirs. I actually did not know that Pegasuses laid eggs. That seems very strange to me. I guess that's their, like, bird side coming out. According to D&D lore, though, and this is just, like, the Greek myth regarding the origin story of Pegasus, a greater Pegasus The lead Pegasus in D&D is born whenever a Medusa is beheaded. So they're bringing in that whole story, which is how the Greek myth describes Pegasus too. So that's kind of cool. One more thing about them. They are always pretty much, I think almost always, white, which is the case in Greek myth. I don't know why, though. I don't know why that's the case. Just beautiful white feather horses that fly around in packs and are good to people that are good. So, kind of fun, kind of cool. Finally, the part you've all been waiting for. How can we use these monsters in combat or in encounters? What do we do with them in D&D?
So now we're going to talk about monsters and all the fun stuff that I like to do as a DM. So we have six to talk about because Gorgons and Medusas are separate creatures here. So the Gorgon, which is found on page 171 of the Monster Manual, it is a CR5 and it is its AC is 19. It has 114 hit points. Its stats are pretty decent, actually. Its strength is +5. Its constitution is +4. Intelligence is -4. Charisma is -4. But those two things are pretty great. You know, it has dark vision. It has a +4 to perception. It cannot be petrified. I think that's kind of cool. So they cannot petrify each other. It has one ability I like. It's a trampling charge, which is essentially if it moves 20 feet towards a creature and then hits it with a gore attack, that target also then makes a strength save or is knocked prone. The cool thing about this is that if the creature then gets knocked prone, it gets to make an additional attack as a bonus action. I like that. So it's a double attack. Gore is a basic attack, you know, it's like about 18 damage. The other interesting thing here, though, is its petrifying breath. So unlike the Medusa, it breathes like a gas and it's a 30-foot cone. It's only a DC 13 con. However, again, we're talking about a challenge rating 5 monster. The creature, if it fails, becomes restrained and it has to repeat the save the next turn. Otherwise, it becomes petrified until greater restoration is used. Which for, you know, a party facing a challenge rating 5, you know, maybe a party level 4 or 5, that could be really crippling, really, really damaging. So here's what I'm imagining. I want this thing to be a sneak attack, Ben. I love these guys being like statues because they're almost metallic, right? An unsuspecting adventurers have to pass. So maybe they're trying to get into like a protected temple or sneak into a bad guy's lair. You want the first move that these things to do to be that trampling charge with a gore. Having players knocked prone sucks, okay? So this particular creature then gets to do a bonus action when things are knocked prone. It's only going to get worse. So not only then the next turn do the players have to give up half their movement to get up, but if they move out of range of the Gorgon still gets an attack of opportunity. There's more. If the player does move away from the Gorgon another more than 20 feet, guess what? This creature gets to do another trampling charge. I think this is a great strategy for early in an encounter. Well, because anytime the creature moves 20 feet and makes an attack, this activates. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great strategy for early encounter with two or more of these things. Like having players take damage and get frustrated while trying to get out of range is going to make the stakes feel higher. What's going to happen? So what I'm going to say is like either the second or third round of combat, the second if the Gorgon got like an attack off without combat starting. So like they snuck up on the players and I want to put the real pressure on there. The petrifying breath is scary. So if you have more than two of these, like honestly, I wish I did. I would want to because I'd have two charging in early from behind and then maybe one jumping in just to do petrifying breath right away because Gorgons can't petrify each other. So the petrifying breath has to be re-rolled to gain the ability back. So having it use it early game means there's better odds that it will work or reuse later because if you wait too long, combat's only going to last as long as it lasts. So having more than one Gorgon increases the odds.
Yes.
So the breath is the real concern here. So because of its stupid high AC for a CR5 creature, this thing is hard to hit. So players will need to be cautious to not get too close. And then honestly, having a player become petrified launches an entire campaign hook to like save or heal that player. And I love how this low-level creature can even put pressure on parties of level 10. Like three of these things could take down mid-level parties or enough to damage them that it like derails their plans.
Oh, for sure, for you know, sure.
Forcing things prone, getting extra attacks off, and then the petrifying breath. Having more than one of these doing that at the same time would be super frustrating.
Oh, devastating even. Yeah.
Yeah.
If
and
you're
like,
not ready.
If you do an encounter builder, like a party of four level 10s against 3 CR5 should be no issue. I don't think these things are going to be no issue. You only need to get one crappy save on the player's turn and one good roll on yours. That's all you like. It's really all it's taken here is some crap luck.
Mm-hmm. And the tables will turn.
Yeah. And even if players don't get fully turned into stone, having that restrained for an entire turn sucks.
Yeah.
So that's my thought on the Gorgon. Medusa, you're never going to believe where I went with this one.
Oh, I'm so excited.
So
what do you got
the
for
real
us?
Gorgon here, I think this is a fun creature, but not because it's not as cool as the Gorgon as far as I'm concerned, especially with the abilities. While it gets three attacks each round, it has range thanks to a longbow. They aren't that special. So let me explain. The Medusa, which is found on page of 214 of the Monster Manual, is a challenge rating 6, so a little bit higher than the Gorgon, not much. It has an AC of 15. Its hit points are 127, which isn't bad. Its strength is +0, so it's not great. Its con's +3. Like, its stats aren't fantastic. It does get bonuses to deception, insight, perception, and stealth, which is fine and all. That's okay. The thing that I like about this is only this. So it has what's called petrifying gaze, which is different. And I'm going to go into that in a minute. It also gets multi-attacks, so it can either make 3 melee attacks, one with its snake hair and 2 with short swords, or 2 range attacks with a longbow. So back to that, the snake hair is cool because it does poison damage, which is always fun. But the longbow does too, Ben.
Wait.
I like the idea of these things being evil snipers with their longbows working for something else.
Yeah.
Having players get hit by arrows they can't see where they're coming from because the longbow has a range of 600 feet.
Wait, that's so far.
Well, so it's a normal roll at 150 feet max, which is still pretty long.
That's still long.
But its disadvantage was 600 feet. But if you have a group of them, I mean, having players get hit by arrows they can't see where they're coming from and taking poison damage can really make for interesting combat.
Mm-hmm.
So petrifying gaze is why we're here, though. While a DC 14 con save isn't awful for a CR6 creature, I'd like to see it a little bit harder. What I do like is that this happens when a creature starts their turn within 30 feet of the Medusa. So it's not an action the Medusa has to do. So I'm imagining these players, I like it either being in the woods, being hit by arrows, or almost in a valley is the one I'm really imagining, surrounded by hills and trees. And so the arrows start raining down. So they're like, okay, we got to figure a way to get past where the arrows are coming from. So maybe the players finally sneak around and catch up to the sniping archers from behind. And maybe the archers are hooded like rangers, right? Well, once that Medusa turns around, those players are now in that gaze, which means it automatically activates.
Oh.
Because it's not an ability. It just happens.
It just happens. Ooh.
So in that regard, I think this is great. The fun kick is that if the player fails a save by 5 or more, they're automatically stoned. Just done.
No.
So I think that can really dampen the player's day. It does work similar to the Gorgon otherwise, with the exception of the fact that it's just a continuous effect, literally continuous. Because this effect kicks in automatically at the start of a player's turn, this is where the Medusa shines. Anytime they're within 30 feet and they can see it, it just happens.
That's so... The Medusa is a killer here.
Well, one on their own isn't bad, but having a group of them, I think, is great. So I want to have multiple Medusas that are Legolas-like archers for your big bad, and they're super frustrating. So maybe they're up on a high up lookout tower or a building or ruins, up on the mountain or on the hillside, sniping your players. And so your players have to find a way to get past the spot or through the spot without being in the open. So I imagine the Medusas are higher up in the overall map, sniping down below at anyone approaching through the valley. Having the players have to get by the Medusas to get to their location is the kicker here. And then having more than one of these means the effects are going to trigger. They're just that much more likely to trigger. I like this because it puts both long-range poison damage and the threat of petrification on the players. Honestly, I feel like you can use this against a mid-level party.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
I kind of love this. So Minotaurs, okay, here comes another movement-based attacks. So let's talk about Minotaurs. They are a challenge rating 3, armor class 14, hit point 76, which is about average for a CR3. The strength is plus 4, which is kind of cool. The con's plus 3, charisma's negative 1, intelligence is negative 2. It's wisdom is plus 3. It does have a charge, just like almost like the Gorgon. If it moves 10 feet and makes an attack, it does extra damage, and then the players can push 10 feet and knocked prone after a save. After a strength save. Where this is kind of cool, it does have a labyrinthine, it's called labyrinthine recall, like it can remember any path it's been on. It gets the barbarian ability Reckless.
Ooh, and what does that do?
So at the start of its turn, it can give itself advantage on all melee attack.
Give itself advantage? So just like...
But then all attacks have advantage on it the next turn. So it's a trade-off. But
it's a trade-off, okay.
This thing, like, its great axe does 17 damage on average, and its gore does 13. Plus, if you're doing charge, it's an extra 9. For a challenge rating 3, this thing's kind of tough. So yeah. I think the charge is the focus, right? It's the bread and butter of the Minotaur. Being able to knock things 10 feet away and prone is amazing. And it adds on to this with the gore attack. Having Reckless is the real fun, though, and... Yes, it's CR13. It has an AC of 14, which is pretty mid. And its HP is not better. But Reckless is just fun because you hit players more often. The real fun here is the labyrinthine recall. Having the monster in a maze, either purposefully made or otherwise like a dungeon system, is where it shines. I think it would be good in a low level, like almost horror-like setting, having the players try to hide. But this thing always finds them. Mm-hmm. I think that's where it fits. Literally like the Mike Myers of D&D.
Yeah, no, that would be excellent.
Okay, so now the creature I didn't know I needed. The Lamia, which is a CR4. Its AC is only 13. Its HP is actually 97, which isn't bad. Its strength is plus 3, con plus 2. Its charisma is plus 3. It gets bonuses to deception, plus 7, insight, and stealth, which is kind of cool. It has dark vision. It's things we expected. Where it gets great is that it has innate spell casting. So it can do disguise self at will anytime it wants. Major image. Yeah. Anytime it wants, major image. Just up and doing it. 3 times a day it can cast charm person, mirror image, scrying, or suggestion. And 2 of those are nasty.
Mm-hmm.
And once a day it can cast Gaius?
Heck if I know.
I don't know how to pronounce it, but that spell is rude. Yes, it has. It's like a multi-attack, but like it's not doing that much damage. Nowhere near the Minotaur, even though it's a higher CR. You know, it's doing about 20 a round, maybe. Where it gets really interesting, though, is it has an ability called... One of its attacks is called Intoxicating Touch.
That sounds dangerous already.
It's actually considered a spell attack, not a melee attack, not a weapon attack. When you hit it, the creature is cursed for an hour. And until it ends, the target has disadvantage on wisdom saving throws and all ability checks.
All ability. Lampia's coming for you.
Yeah. So, and again, like it's a CR4 in the Monster Manual, page 201. Like it's not really meant to be super strong, but I honestly think this thing could like destroy an entire campaign.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, she's trying to eat you. Like. Yeah.
And for a CR4, it's awful to deal with, right? 2 attacks, multiple spells, various other actions. I think this thing's super frustrating. I love that it has disguise self. It has bonuses. You know, again, we said deception, stealth, and insight. I want this to be a villain for a lower level story arc. That's what I want. I love that it can pretend to be someone else. I'd use that. I love that it has intoxicating touch, which destroys players' wisdom saving throws. Having a creature do so stealthily, like so maybe it's part of a social interaction, is what I want. It makes an attack, but you don't know it's an attack because you're not taking damage.
Oh, because you don't even know. Yeah. Ooh. All the deception is so
like juicy. Because it has a bonus of stealth, I would almost be doing it as a stealth check the way that players tend to do sometimes. They're like, well, I stealthily cast a spell. Fine. If you can do that, so can this thing.
Sneaky.
And then like players' wisdom saves are gone and all their ability checks. And it can do it an unlimited number of times. And it can repeat it after an hour or within an hour.
So literally so vicious.
I love this thing. I think that the fact that it gets 3 uses of charm person is awesome. I want this to be like a surprise villain where she's lowering the party's guard the entire time. So like she's manipulating them socially. I want that. So, you know, she gets 2 attacks. Not great. They don't do a lot of damage. Her getting the spell Gaius, whatever, is fun. She can control a player and force them to do their bidding. Do you know how much damage a player does with that spell if they try to ignore it?
Tell me.
5d10 psychic.
That could literally knock you out. Like,
you could, yeah. So, like, the creature can decide, you know, if it tries to act in a manner counter to what she's asking. But then, you know, like, it takes that damage.
Gosh, that's brutal.
Yeah, I love this so much. I would have her controlling one of the party members and, like, you as a DM texting the player, like, what to do. Because, like, when we were playing our one shot that Colin, or it ended up being, like, a three shot that Colin was DMing, like, I picked a Ghostwise halfling and they can talk telepathically. So I would text, you know, my friend who was playing my in-game wife, and the DM was on the text chain. But, like, you know, as a DM, that is a tool you can use, especially if you're trying to communicate discreetly.
Right. Yeah.
So I want to see her doing this. I want to see a long, drawn out, multi-session bad guy who manipulates and plays with their minds. I love mirror image and major image being here too. I honestly think she could be like running like a crime syndicate or something. Like, I want her to be the boss.
Yeah.
I want her to be the boss in like the game's first story arc. That's what I want.
I'm telling you, the matriarch girl boss energy is here.
But like, she can disguise herself as anything. So like, you could find out that she literally was like four different people you met.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many possibilities here.
Like, and then the fact that she gets access to all those spells is where it gets like just nasty. Having the party like do things, being forced to do things without being without them understanding why is frustrating.
Yeah.
Especially because she could just keep changing her appearance. So yeah,
she's never gonna fit a box. She's always gonna be shifting.
I like that. So next up we have, how do we say their names?
Is the Eidolon?
Eidolon. Eidolon.
Yeah.
So these things are interesting. They are a challenge rating 12. They have an armor class of 9, hit points of 63. They have a fly speed of 40. Their stats are all pretty much in the negative, minus intelligence and wisdom and charisma. They have a bonus of wisdom saving throw. They have lots of resistances, which I'll talk about in a second, and immunities, and that's kind of cool. But besides that, they're just kind of there. They are considered an undead, so they are kind of like a spirit here. It's incorporeal, so it can move through objects and such. What happens, though, if it ends its turn inside an object other than a sacred statue, it does take force damage. So when it occupies a space occupied by the sacred statue, it disappears, and the statue becomes a creature under this thing's control. So it literally takes over the statue. It has advantage on saving throws against an effect that turns undead. So clerics, haha, that sucks. It does get like an ability to frighten. We'll talk about that in a second. So the statue is really fun, though. The statue has an AC of 19, hit points of 95, which isn't great for, I mean, a challenge rating 12. However, it has all the resistances and such I'll talk about in a second. And its strength is +4, +4 wisdom, +3 charisma, +2 intelligence, +4 constitution. Yeah. The ghost controls a statue. It can only be forced out with like detect good and evil or dispel good and evil, something like that. It's fun. Where it gets fun though is that it gets 2 attacks every turn. Its slam attack does an average of 43 damage per turn. So it can do 2 of those. So we're talking almost 90 damage. And it also has a rock attack where it throws rocks up to 240 feet and for about 40 damage.
How big are the rocks?
Pretty big. So finally it's something big and beefy. I love that it can move through anything. I think the real fun here is a statue. So here's what I want to do. I want this party to be escorting like a companion who's maybe an archaeologist or someone who hired them to explore a dangerous ancient temple. And I want the party to fight how do we say it?
I've been saying Eidolon.
Sure, that's right. How we're saying it. Only the companion traps it in the statue. I almost want it to be like a spirit that's summoned and then it gets trapped in the statue.
Yeah.
So they have to fight it as a spirit and then the statue.
Ooh.
So that way it's like a double boss fight. Yeah.
Oh, the health bar is refilling.
Yes. The statue is fun because of the decent AC, good resistances. And we're talking resistance to acid, fire, lightning, and then the normals, bludgeoning, piercing, slashing, non-magic weapons. It has immunities, so charmed, exhaustion, frightened, paralyzed, petrified, poisoned, and also cold damage, necrotic damage, poison damage. So it has immunities and resistances to 6 damage types. I think that's what makes it fun. Yeah. It's just a big old hitter. And it, you know, doing about 80 to 90 points of damage each round is sometimes scary. Even for a CR 12 party. Like, that could take out a few players in one turn.
And you can't take it out back because it resists everything.
Yeah. So I think because of the resistances and the AC, before it's a statue, it has all the resistances, but its AC and HP are garbage. However, the Divine Dread is amazing. It can cause creatures to be frightened or stunned. Literally, if they're in a tight space, they become stunned. That's how it reads. I love the idea of it being applied and then it being forced into the statue, gaining the resistances and immunity while the players are frightened.
Oh, yeah. Oh, because the players might not even expect this to happen.
I think it, yeah. Frightened as in the condition frightened. Yeah, so it makes scary combat and it makes this thing like super taxing.
Oh my gosh. And they're freaked out the entire time.
Yep. Yep. I'm not going to do Pegasus because I think we're out of time here, but I think hopefully those are good suggestions.
Yeah. Well, and also Pegasus is more of like a companion, I would think.
Well, like, I like the idea of a plot hook that the players had, maybe they were given a Pegasus, mm-hmm. and then purposely putting your players in a morally questionable situation, yeah. where maybe they have to pick between two outcomes, both of which suck. And then the Pegasus Ooh. Being like, yeah, I don't like you guys anymore.
Like, I'm not vibing with this. Yeah.
And then them having to regain its favor.
That would be good. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I like that morally questionable plot points. Those are always spicy.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. So that's where I'm at. I had a lot of fun here, and hopefully everyone else did too.
Yeah, and I encourage you, on your own time, look up all of the Greek monsters in D&D that we did not cover today, because there's literally like a dozen.
Don't
more.
Tell them that. Don't take away another episode from us, Ben.
That's true. We could do Greek part two. That's true.
But we would call it Greece part two. Greek is the word. It's okay. This one we're going to name after yogurt, probably.
Okay. Well, I hope you all loved learning about Greek myths, monsters, and strategies.
And yogurt.
And yogurt and various other things. We will see you next time on Ben Richting's Guide to Monsters and Lore.
Adios.